Good evening, and welcome to Art World Innovators, exploring stories of innovation in the art world. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and you're listening to UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Our guest this evening is Dr. Susanna Avery Quash, Senior Research Curator in the History of Collecting at the National Gallery in London. She is responsible for the pre-1900 objects in the gallery's history collection and for activities associated with the gallery's research on buying, collecting, and display. Susanna studied modern languages at the University of Cambridge, art history at the Courtauld Institute of Art, and the University of London, and earned her PhD at the University of Cambridge. Susanna has published numerous scholarly articles, reviews, exhibition catalogs, and books, including Art for the Nation, The East Lakes and the Victorian Art World, written in 2011, The Georgian London Townhouse Building, Collecting and Display, published in 2019, London and the Emergence of a European Art Market, 1780 to 1820, published in 2019, to name a few. In addition, Susanna has organized many conferences on historical art topics, is involved in a variety of organizations, has an honorary research fellow at Birkbeck University of London and at the University of Buckingham's Humanities Research Institute. Welcome to Art World Innovators, and thank you so much for joining us this evening.
It's my pleasure. I'm very, very delighted to have been asked, and I look forward to having a discussion that's useful for your students, Susan.
Thank you. Over the course of your career, you've been highly recognized for your extensive research, publications, exhibitions, and so much more. What originally drew you into the study of art history and curating?
Well, I think there were a number of different influences, and one of them was my upbringing, I should say. I personally think that childhood and youth, you know, really do at their best sow wonderful seeds and plant wonderful memories. Sometimes I think your students may end up doing something very different from their parents. Well, in my case, I absolutely followed in my dad's footsteps. My father, Charles Avery, is an historian of Florentine Renaissance sculpture. So he tended to combine research trips with family holidays, especially in Italy. And so that way I got to see a lot of paintings and sculptures in Italian collections and some rather out of the way places. I remember a really lovely trip, Susan, one year when I must have been about eight with my sisters, where when we were taking off to a little town called Possagno near Treviso, and we went to see the home, the former home of an Italian neoclassical sculptor, Antonio Canova. And it was quite different from the sort of more dry English museums I'd seen. So that was a really wonderful experience. I also think that one's career path sometimes follows teachers that you've been inspired by. And I had wonderful, engaged teachers at school and university who would open my eyes to objects and ideas and people who had written about objects or mounted exhibitions about them or made films about them. And I remember in particular one trip when I was about 17 with school, and we went to Paris, and my art history teacher showed me round the gardens of the great French 19th century sculptor Rodin. And it was wonderful to see these sculptures in Paris in gardens and not in a normal museum space. And that really captured my imagination. And then when I grew older, I tried to use opportunities to experiment with different types of art history jobs, if you like, internships in museums, working in a London auction house, trying out a period of months as an academic. And from all of those experiences, Susan, I actually found that for myself, I like the museum context of having objects around me on a daily basis. And I was rather upset when I worked in an auction house to see these lovely objects that I'd grown fond of disappearing when the sales happened and going into a private collection or out of sight. And also in a university context, often one doesn't work on a daily basis with works of art. You're surrounded by books and so on. And I think also to answer your question, I became very interested in connecting people with art, which again I think is something that working in a museum or an art gallery allows one to do, perhaps more easily than is the case if you work in the commercial art world, where money sometimes, I think, gets in the way of allowing everyone to enter into the conversation with art, or in the academy where audiences also tend to be a little bit restricted, perhaps to younger or more academic people. I think the attraction of the museum world, for me and maybe for many of your listeners, would be to think about it being a place, a locus, where everybody's welcomed in, no matter what age, sex, class, creed or religion they belong to. So that's what I think drew me personally to a career in the museum world.
As the senior research curator with the National Gallery, and in your position being responsible for the pre-1900 objects and the activities that are associated with the gallery's research, can you elaborate on what this distinctive role involves for our audience?
Yes, of course. My role is, I should say, Susan, a little bit unusual because it combines research that you might associate perhaps more with just some types of museum and also the university world, but also with a lot of teaching the wider public and a range of public output. So on the one hand, I have a curator's job, but I look after just the historical objects in the museum's collection, and that's to say paintings that have been perhaps painted by one of our former museum directors, because a little known fact is that until the 1920s, all of our museum directors were in fact practicing painters. So the historical collection has examples of their work. We also include in the historical collection all the drawings that architects have made for extensions to our buildings over our 200-year history. And that's stored in the museum. We also have a number of one-off objects. For example, we have the gold medal that the famous landscape painter John Constable was awarded when he exhibited the Heywayne in Paris in 1824. So that's the type of object that I look after, and I try to get them out into exhibitions that we mount ourselves, or I'm very happy to lend them to objects to exhibitions when people want them. I also manage two of the academic research strands that were set up to draw attention to the work that the museum does. One of them is called Buying, Collecting and Display, and that looks at the past history of objects before they enter the National Gallery's collection. So who were the owners? How much did a particular picture cost? What does that tell us about changes of taste? What did audiences think about them? And what journeys they made to reach the National Gallery? So that's one research strand, Buying, Collecting and Display. And a second one that I help run is called Art and Religion. And that looks at our paintings from what their subject matter says about maybe their origins in the Christian story, but also what they say about faith structures or ideas about love, death, hope, those sorts of things, which are applicable to many religions. So I also manage colleagues who do research projects in these strands. I teach myself on various of our master's degree courses, and for a number of years have been a curator involved with supervision for PhD students. It's quite interesting because at the moment in the UK, the government supports PhD students who don't just sit within the university, but they can also now be associated with museums, and they're called collaborative doctoral partnerships. I think the advantage for students, Susan, in those cases is that students not only get a doctorate from a university, but get the chance to work in museums and to showcase some fruits of their doctoral work to a much broader audience than they would normally associate with in a university. So they might put on a display, or they might run some little films, or they might organise a lecture series, and they can put all of those outputs through a museum. So, for example, in our case, we have many millions of visitors each year, and so the PhD student can engage with far wider publics than they would do just if they were associated with a university alone. So apart from all that teaching, I do organise, as you already mentioned, a number of conferences. I try to put out high-level scholarship in a user-friendly way through conferences that are meant for not only specialists but also for general audiences on a whole range of topics, from women writers on the old masters, the reception history of Leonardo da Vinci's work in Britain, Georgian London townhouses, that's just to name three recent exhibitions and conferences I've been involved with. And often we get books on the top of that spring from those conferences, which allow a different audience to engage with our research too. So I hope that that's given you a sort of smorgasbord idea of the rich variety of events and activities I'm associated with. I love my role because it's very diverse, and I get to deal with members of the public, with colleagues in other museums, in universities, and with students as well. So it's a rich and diverse field, and I like making connections between works of art and different types of people.
And in your passion for connecting different kinds of works and people, can you tell us a bit more about a particular exhibition that would have reflected those passions and that you were really excited about?
Yes, I think a good example of that would be a twofold exhibition that I helped organise in 2011 and 12, which all stemmed from research I did into the National Gallery's first director, a very influential and inspiring Victorian called Charles Eastlake. I put on a small exhibition at the National Gallery in 2011, and then I decided that I wanted to take the name and the life of Charles Eastlake more broadly to the UK. So I set up a partnership with Plymouth City Art Gallery and Museum, which is in the southwest of England. And I chose that venue, Susan, because Charles Eastlake was actually born in Plymouth. And so I thought it made good sense to inspire some civic pride in the Plymouthians by reintroducing this great and important figure of the Victorian art world to them. And so we found some works of art, some paintings that Charles Eastlake, who was originally a painter, had produced and were sitting in the stalls in Plymouth City Art Museum. And we got them out on show and we were able to do a very exciting all about Charles Eastlake's origin in Plymouth, and that drew paintings from the Plymouth collection and the National Gallery. And what we also put into the exhibition were examples of correspondence and some of Eastlake's notebooks, so we were able to make links between archival documents associated with the purchase of paintings abroad as director and then the paintings themselves. And I wanted to get the students at Plymouth University involved, and so a group of about 30 young people between the ages of 18 and 25 got very excited to learn more about this great figure from Plymouth's past, but also to engage themselves with experiences of talking to the public. So they put on a series of lunchtime talks. They devised the most incredible walking tours around Plymouth, showing members of the public where Eastlake had been born and so on and so forth. They produced little comics for children, and altogether it was an absolutely fabulous collaboration, and they went on to become runners-up, actually, in a volunteering programme that was devised in England. So I was very, very proud of what the students did, and they said to me they were very grateful for the opportunity to do something apart from art historical study during their time at Plymouth University, and actually to have a chance to engage with the general public and to showcase work, whether that was a lecture or a walking tour or a comic they'd produced, and to be actually able to engage with art and to take it to the public and to be responsible for this sort of work. So I was very happy to be able to enable these young people to have this sort of experience.
To be able to take their particular strengths and yes, bring art history to life, that's just fabulous.
Yes, they said afterwards that it encouraged them to carry on working in the public sector because they got such a thrill from trying to explain in their own terms what certain historical paintings meant for them. And they became so engaged that the public got very enthused by young people talking passionately about historical art. And I've kept in contact with a number of the students, and it's been fascinating and very rewarding to see their journeys in careers in the art world. Yes.
Can you tell us about any research projects you're currently working on, perhaps a preview of what is in store to celebrate the National Gallery's forthcoming 200th anniversary in 2024?
Well, one of the projects that we're working on is to try and get more information about the provenance of some of our paintings on our website, because we feel at the moment the public can't easily get any information about the past histories of our fabulous paintings. So what we're going to try and do is a digital project that will allow the past histories of our paintings to be put on online, which I think will be a very exciting way of the public being able to tap into the journeys that our paintings made from the time that they were originally produced by an artist, and then some of them were originally made for Italian churches, for example, in medieval or Renaissance Italy. Others were portraits of English aristocrats and were originally intended to hang in long galleries in country houses in this country, for example. But then they've made various journeys and they've had many owners. They've been in different settings. And what we want to try and do is illuminate the journeys and the different contexts that those paintings were originally sitting in before they ended up finally on the walls of Trafalgar Square in London. And a second project that I want to work on in anticipation of our bicentenary in 2024 is also really to show the public how the nature of the National Gallery has changed over its 200-year history, because when the gallery was originally founded in 1824, it was a very different sort of gallery than the one it is today. There weren't any labels. The pictures were hung in a very different arrangement. They weren't hung chronologically by school and date. They were hung in an aesthetic array arranged by subject matter or by colouring or by size even. And in fact, originally, they didn't even hang in Trafalgar Square where they do now. They were hanging in a gentleman's London townhouse in Pall Mall, just about 5 minutes walk away from the National Gallery. 38 paintings were bought from the collection of a man called John Julius Angerstein. And when he died, the British government bought the 38 paintings, and they also bought the lease on his London townhouse, because they had no designated National Gallery. So what I'd like to be able, in some shape or form, to tell the gallery visitors more about are the origins and early years and development of our national collection, away from being a treasure trove of acknowledged masterpieces sitting in a gentleman's London townhouse, and the way it evolved into a public-facing art gallery that was really meant to be a survey collection, able to demonstrate, if you like, visually, the entire story of Western European painting from its origins in Italy in the 13th century up to the present day, and how, with that change of heart in the type of painting that was bought, came a change of heart also in the way it was displayed chronologically and geographically, with a lot of aids for the public in terms of labels and catalogues and good lighting, and lots of thought about the colour of the walls and frames and so on. I think that 200 years of the gallery's history will be a wonderful opportunity to crack open some of these fascinating stories about the type of art the gallery has shown, the way it's been displayed, and the publics for which the National Collection was intended, and how things have changed quite radically over 200 years. And I hope that what we can do is reinvigorate that story once again and encourage many new audiences who may not necessarily feel that familiar with going into art galleries, and by putting on a variety of extremely exciting and innovative displays and films and conferences and so on, putting on a range of activities to entice a range of new visitors to walk into the gallery, in the hope that in the next century to come, the gallery can continue to offer great art for an even greater diversity of people. That would really make me extremely happy, if we can continue to welcome ever more people into the doors of Trafalgar Square.
Well, I'd like to thank you so much for taking the time to share your insight and invaluable advice with our audience, and the exciting stories that you've had to tell us. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, and I wish you continued success.
Thank you very much, Susan. It's been a pleasure to talk, and I hope that some of the tales I've been able to tell will inspire many of your students and other listeners to go to their local art gallery, read an art history journal, and really look carefully, because art is such a wonderful, exciting resource for everyone, and it teaches us so much about ourselves and our histories. Thank you very much indeed for inviting me to speak.
Thank you so very much. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and we thank you for listening to Art World Innovators here on UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Join us again next Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. for more on today's innovators in the art world. Our guest this evening is Ryan Mayberry, founder of Art Moi, an initiative to simplify the process of documenting art. Art Moi is a creation registry platform that provides professional artists, collectors, and galleries with tools to catalog, organize, track, and share provenance-based information on a work of art or collectible object over time. The Art Moi platform provides a foundation for the adoption of new technology and enables artists and creators to participate in how their work is managed and used. Art Moi has recently gained institutional support from Western University, the Art Gallery of Ontario, and the Art Canada Institute, where they are collaborating to establish a standard program for building digital catalog raisons for some of Canada's most celebrated artists. Art Moi has recently adopted a pay-what-you-can pricing model, a unique approach known as the Patreon model for funding creative individuals. Through Ryan's two passions, art and technology, he and the company strive to fulfill Art Moi's mission, to empower artists and make art more accessible to everyone. Welcome to Art World Innovators, and thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Happy to be talking to you.
Can you tell us about your passion for art and technology and how they have led to the founding of Art Moi?
think I come by both those passions quite organically. I grew up in an art gallery. My father started his first gallery back in the 1970s, so I've grown up in that environment, surrounded by art, surrounded by artists, and just generally being exposed to it on a day-by-day basis. I've also just always been kind of a nerd, so I taught myself how to program computers when I was a little kid in the 80s, and it's just something I always sort of stuck with as a hobby as a kid, and that eventually turned into work, and I started my first sort of professional jobs was as a computer programmer in a variety of industries outside of the art world, and eventually I was able to just kind of merge the two, art being something that I'm passionate about and software engineering and coding and development just being something that I enjoy doing.
You were also fortunate to have been a speaker at the TEDx in Winnipeg a year ago, and you spoke of ArtMoi's philosophy. Can you elaborate on that for us?
We view ourselves as a very creator-centric organization, something that I kind of learned just being part of the art world and working in galleries and working with auction houses and especially dealing with historical art and secondary market art. So as opposed to contemporary work coming straight from an artist, working with artwork that comes out of an estate or things that people have inherited or were gifted or just, you know, kind of found in flea markets. And something that I sort of noticed early on is that details, historical accounts, the provenance behind a work of art, even just, you know, dates of when works were created, that type of information was very hard to find. Typically, the person who was in possession of a painting didn't know the whole story behind it, and the ability to kind of research it was kind of lost. And having grown up in that environment and knowing a lot of artists in their lifetime as they were actively producing, I knew that, you know, artists were the best source of information about their own artwork, but the stories and the information and the knowledge that they have was never getting captured, because the process of documenting a work of art typically doesn't happen until late into an artist's career, and often after they've already passed away. So the ability to get authoritative information is difficult because the primary source of that authoritative information is no longer around. So our philosophy, being artist-centric, means to give artists the tools and the capability to capture those stories and capture that provenance in their lifetime and do it in a way that's kind of organic and just ties in with their own productivity needs and their own just the day-to-day needs that an artist has in managing their own career. So we want to help them be successful artists, but at the same time allow them to generate an official record of provenance around their work while they do that. And it's something that is kind of absent from the art world. Most technology tools and productivity tools or tech-based tools that are developed for the art world are typically developed for large art galleries, large museums, large auction houses, and not for the individual artist, which, in my opinion, just seems a little counterproductive, because the artist is the start of the supply chain. And that is the point where you need to capture authoritative and authentic information about a work of art.
So are you moving towards advancing a standardized means of artwork identification?
Yeah, we are working with organizations like the Art Canada Institute, the Arts and Humanitarians Department at Western University, to determine what the best practices are for gathering provenance, storing provenance, verifying that information, and making sure that it is accessible and usable from a technology standpoint, not just now, but as technology evolves. So Western University just started this September a course in digital futures of the art world that was put together in collaboration with ourselves and the Art Canada Institute. So they have humanitarians and fine arts students that are studying these best practices and doing a practicum in the process of compiling official catalog resumes on some celebrated Canadian artists. And our hopes is, you know, with that program and that syllabus, it's something that we can share and make available to other schools and other organizations. There needs to be a standardization in what type of information is gathered and how it's gathered and how it's verified. And then we ourselves at ArtMoi are trying to establish a technology standard of how artwork information is communicated from one computer system to another computer system, and how the data can be communicated, secured, and verified digitally as well.
And you've also begun to use a pay-what-you-can model. Can you tell us a little bit more about this company and your collaboration with their model?
Sure. So artists, individual collectors, galleries, anybody that has a use for ArtMoi can access our system under a pay-what-you-can model, which means they can pay us whatever they want to pay us, starting from $0 all the way up to however much they want to give us. We've adopted this model through another online platform called Patreon. Patreon allows any creative individual to sell their work or get support for what they do through just general patronage, something that's kind of been in the art world for hundreds and hundreds of years. Some of the most famous works of art were produced because of patrons, because of people who want to enable an artist to do great things, so they support them financially so that they have the ability and the time to create freely. We view ourselves at ArtMoi as artists. We don't paint pictures or sculpt things, but we write code and we develop platforms, and for us there's a similar process for how we build what we build and how an artist builds what they build. So the pay what you can model and the general concept of patronage, I think, works really well for us because it enables artists at any stage of their career to access the full breadth of features and functionality and technology that we can provide. Artists don't have the luxury typically of a steady income. Their cash flow ebbs and flows on a daily or weekly basis, and it often ebbs more than it flows. They don't have the means often to invest heavily into technology, and yet they still need to protect their legacy and their copyright and interest in everything they create from day one. They need that protection right when they start their career. They don't just need it when they become successful and can afford a database to log things in or afford to make a website or afford to produce legal contracts for their work and those types of things. They need it from day one. So the pay what you can model allows them to access all the technology tools that we can provide, and they can pay us when they have the ability to do so. And that model or that philosophy, I think, lends itself very well to the natural instincts of an artist and natural motivation of an artist, and we found that it works extremely well for what we do. We have a lot of artists that can't pay us anything but support us through social media and word of mouth and will pay us whenever they can. We have some people who pay us and support us with hundreds of dollars a month who don't really need a lot of access to our tools, but they see the value in what we do and want other people to be able to access it as well. So it's certainly a different business model, especially in the software world, but given that we're really kind of focused on a specific niche and a user that has quite unique needs and capabilities, it works really well for us.
Well, we're just running out of time, so I'd like to thank you very much for speaking with us today and sharing your story and the exciting developments of ArtMoi. I wish you continued success.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. That was Ryan Mayberry, founder of ArtMoi, an initiative to simplify the process of documenting art. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and we thank you for listening to Art World Innovators here on UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Join us again next Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. for more on today's innovators in the art world.